hola, all you diners and travelers.
Oh, hola, she says. Oh, my goodness. What's she doing next?
What are we doing next?
What are we
On the menu is going to be taking our listeners south of the border, or at least close to south of the border interviews.
Yeah, we could be accused of pandering, I guess.
Why?
We're pandering to the Hispanics who helped re-elect our favorite man for president. So it's appropriate that we should pay some tribute, I think, to what our friends close to the border or south of the border have given to us. And so we assemble them in one program for you. And
one of the best things that they've given us is
tequila. So we decided we would start off today's program with a lesson for you in fine tequila.
Yes.
From someone who makes it.
Now talk about an interesting career track. John Hansen, you've done a little of this and a lot of that.
That's right.
How did you end up producing premium tequila?
Well, with my business partners that were been in distribution here in the United States for a little over 8 years, one of them is an old friend of mine, and his brother-in-law was distilling some great tequilas and had some product being imported into the U.S. and really was looking for a better alternative to the importer that he was with. And so my good friend Juan called me and asked me for some input and advice on what they should do, and that's really how the whole thing started. Our crew have been already making some great tequilas, and so we put together the importing company to get them into the United States, and we started in San Francisco self-distributing, and now we're in 23 states across the U.S.
Okay, and it's manufactured in Mexico, or produced in Mexico.
As with all tequilas, it's an appellation of origin spirit, just like champagne or cognac, so it has to be made in a certain area with certain methods.
Okay, and there are different classifications.
That is correct. Okay, the first thing is to have either the tequila, which is 51%, which we call a mixto, which is 51% the juice of the tequila and a Weber Blue Agave, and the other 49% can be cane, it can come from corn, it can come from anything else. The other classification is 100% Blue Agave tequila, and that is really where premium tequilas are, and that's really what you want to look for when you're buying a good quality tequila. It needs to be 100% Blue Agave.
Brand name is?
Clase Azul, like the blue class in Spanish, C-L-A-S-E, Azul.
And why is that?
And the blue has to do with the fact that the Blue Agave is the plant you're using, right?
That's the primary reason, yes.
Oh, okay.
And also that it's a luxury, top of the line, and blue representing first place. We're really going for really good, the best high quality for all of our tequilas.
I thought that was gold.
Yeah, that's true.
Now, let's see, what was it we tried? We had the Añejo, but not the supremely Añejo aged.
The aging, basically the classifications, you have Blanco or Silver, which is unaged, Reposado, which is aged from 2 months up to 12 months, which our Reposado we age for 8 months. And then the Añejo classification, that's from 12 months to 36 months, which we don't have in regular production yet. And then the Extra Añejo classification, which is 36 months or 3 years and beyond. And that's our Extra Añejo we age for 5 years. Limited production and very high price. Retails about $2,000 a bottle.
Now, I can't believe that. How do you get $2,000 a bottle for tequila? I mean, I don't get
it. It's like how do you get $50,000 a bottle for Scotch whiskey or cognac?
We're kind of in that the Louis XIII for the tequila market. Most expensive tequilas in regular production. It's a very, very exquisite, fantastic, fantastic spirit.
Now, Anne and I actually had a little bit of an argument, which I think you can help us resolve, because she thinks that the sample that was sent to us was Reposado, and I don't think it was, because it was colorless. Now, Reposado and Añejo both have some color, correct?
Yes.
So then,
Reposado, just by nature of being aged on oak, it's going to pick up some color.
Yeah, it's really funny. I mean, this is almost laughable, and I injected here only because I just came across it just recently, and it made me laugh. We have a company in Pittsburgh called Wiggle, W-I-G-L-E, which makes whiskey. They say they make a Scotch whiskey and they make a rye whiskey. The latest thing they're doing is they're selling bottles of their white spirit side by side with a small barrel, and you age it yourself.
And because, I like it. And I'd like to try that.
Because
that sounds like a really fun idea.
But because it's a small barrel, I guess they don't. You don't have to age it like 5 years. You only have to age it like 6 weeks.
I guess so. With that much surface area, you could probably get a whole lot out of that wood. A short amount of time.
No, I don't know. I'm sure they're not the only people who are doing it because it didn't say it was a patented process. So if you want to try it, I guess you can. But I'd love for you to call it Peter's Tequila when you do that.
Pedro's Tequila. Now, what was it that we were drinking then?
It was the Blanca.
Blanca. That wasn't $89.99 a bottle.
The Plata versus the Reposado, I would say that universally we can say it, retail for the Plata is $79.99 and for the Reposado, $89.99.
And we had one of those?
And you should have had one of each of those, I think.
No, we only got one bottle.
Well, you're gonna have to deal with wish fulfillment department.
Yes. We got one with a really fancy bottle.
Okay, and it was a white ceramic and it has blue paint decoration?
It was glass.
It wasn't
blue.
Ceramic, it was glass.
It was glass. Okay, so that's our Blanco, our Plata.
Okay, all right.
And which one is that? That retails for what?
That's your retail for a 750 milliliter bottle, $79.99.
Okay.
I think we got a smaller bottle than that.
Yeah, I think we did too.
Yeah, I think there was probably a 375 mil.
And it's for sipping.
See, that's what we're supposed to be talking. You're supposed to be giving us recipes.
Well, we're going to move up. We're going to move on to that.
Cocktails, but I wouldn't spend that kind of money on tequila and then blend it with junk.
Blend it with other junk.
Well, that's something I think the majority of our Class A's little fan base out there sips it or maybe has it on the rocks, but it's really just a nice lineup of sipping tequilas. But at the same time, with a really high-quality spirit, you can also have a lot of fun with some other ingredients to put together some really nice, delicious cocktails.
So what are some of those, John?
Well, you know, one of them, a real fun one that we had last night at a restaurant in San Francisco called Jardiniere.
We know Tracy.
You know Tracy? Yeah, she's out there having her 15-year anniversary party.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, so it was a really nice event, and Greg Stone in there, who runs the bar, put together his take on the Monte Carlo. He made a Monte Carlos. So instead of rye whiskey, he's using our Reposado tequila, Benedictine, and a dash of bitters.
Oh, wow, interesting.
And basically shaking, straining, putting that into a cocktail glass, and it was absolutely delicious.
Is anybody doing anything like a Sazerac with because that would probably work, too.
I think it would. I think with the Reposado, because of the flavor profile and the viscosity and all those good components we're getting out of the oak, I think you can really do a lot with any of the classic cocktails that are using any of the whiskeys, the bourbon, rye, et cetera, et cetera.
So you could do a Tac-Tac Matin or a Tec Matin.
Tec-Arac.
You could do a Negroni. You could do almost anything.
I just read there's something that's way more hip now than aged cocktails, but I can't remember what it was.
Well, that's because you drank too many of them.
I drank too many of them.
You had too much of that wiggle whiskey.
There you go, wiggle whiskey.
Yeah.
There's a lot of mileage you can get out of wiggle whiskey, I think.
Right, but it another thing to remind people, it is okay to do it on the rocks.
Yes, I think so. I mean, basically what you're doing, when you introduce ice or water, you start to change the flavor profile a little bit, and that's why people will add a little bit of water to their single malts and their whiskeys, because it does kind of open things up a little bit and maybe soften things. I like to just use one or maybe two ice cubes, just because I like to have it a little bit, drink things just a little bit cooler, but I don't want to water it down too much. So that's typically what I'll do, depending on the temperature. If it's cold out there, I'll just sip it neat. But I do like to put a cube in there just to have a little bit more of a cold mouthfeel.
And you don't do like we do with our vodka, which is we keep it in the freezer, because doing that would kill the flavor.
Right. That's anything when you freeze things,
My old thoughts were that vodka should be absolutely tasteless, and now I've been tasting vodkas that have all these botanical components, and I love them.
It's amazing what people have been doing in the last few years with vodka, that is for sure.
I'm not so crazy about flavored vodkas, though. Now, you do some flavoring things, don't you?
Well, we have a spirit that's a brand called La Pinta, and it's pomegranate and tequila. And this is really, I like to make the comparison that it's like limoncello for Italians. This drink in Jalisco, it's called the Ponche de Granada, and that's what really inspired my partner Arturo to produce this with pomegranate and tequila, because it's the regional drink, just like the limoncello is rather a regional thing in Italy.
What happened to Juan?
I'm sorry?
I thought Juan was your partner.
Juan and Arturo.
Okay, you have two partners.
He has two partners, yeah.
I'm just trying to get it all straight.
Arturo,
I gotcha.
Arturo is the man with the touch for making tequila.
That is correct. Arturo is our master distiller, and Juan really runs the house, runs the company. He's our CFO, and he keeps me in line with my expense account.
Okay, well, I'm sure somebody needs to do that.
Right, somebody does.
So did you have another cocktail to give us?
Yeah, let me give you, hold on. Okay, and I can give you another one that's really kind of inspired by a classic cocktail.
Okay.
Which is, if you're familiar with the Moscow Mule, which is simply vodka, lime, and ginger.
Oh, that's interesting, yeah.
We have somebody down in San Diego that's doing a Classe Azul Cucumber Mint Mule, and he's doing an ounce and a half of Classe Azul Plata, an ounce and a half of fresh squeezed lime, and muddle some mint and cucumber, build the cocktail right on top of that, and on the rocks, and fill with ginger beer.
Huh, wow.
That sounds good.
Yeah, sounds good.
Yeah, some really good, fun flavors there. Or simply, with the Classe Azul Silver, the Plata, an ounce and a half of fresh lime on the rocks, and fill it with ginger beer, and you've got more of a traditional mule, but made with tequila instead of vodka.
Now, you have to use ginger beer, not ginger ale, right?
Well, I think you can use ginger ale, but the traditional recipe, I believe, comes with the ginger beer, so it does change the flavor profile on there. Ginger beer versus ginger ale.
Yeah, I think ginger beer as a whole is a lot better product. Prince Harry should probably drink more ginger beer.
Sounds like it.
he was probably having some of that extra añejo of yours.
maybe that's what it was.
Anyway, we understand there are pictures of a sunbathing Duchess of Cambridge on the internet these days. So who knows what's happening next?
Oh, I didn't see
that. Yeah, well, you didn't see it. You didn't hear about it.
I saw the headline.
Yeah, I heard the headline on the Today Show this morning. Fortunately, they did not show the picture. Something about this is wrong. So we should just sip more tequila. We should be like Jimmy Buffett.
There we go. Biggest cheerleader of tequila and margaritas.
There we go. Well, John Hansen, thank you so much for joining us today on The Menu. We wish you continued success. You know, we hope that if you have the opportunity to do so, you'd be able to keep us supplied.
I think we can work on that, for sure. Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you're fun to talk to, and it's really livening my afternoon of interviews.
It's almost good.
Next time we'll have a little tequila for you to liven it up even more.
Okay.
It's almost there. It's almost the cocktail hour.
On the East Coast.
John, have a great day.
Thanks, great day. Thank you much. I appreciate it.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And right after the break, we'll have some people who have a lot to say about what you might eat with your tequila. So don't go away. We'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And here we are again, bringing you...
You usually say, welcome back. What's the matter? You're changing your wording here. You're becoming unpredictable. I don't know what you're going to do next.
But we have here, I would say you have an expert, and then you have a family, three generations of family, and that's they're experts,
sort of,
too.
So sort of two views of the cooking in Mexico outside of Taco Bell.
Yeah, and the first one is Cocina Mexicana, and let's let that interview roll.
And then right after that.
Oh, yeah, we're going to have a break.
Right after that, we have three generations. Muy Bueno, which was all what came out of Grandma's kitchen or Nana's kitchen, but three generations of people talking about what it's like to cook Mexican as a family.
Well, I'm a bit intimidated by our next guest, Marilyn Townsend. Marilyn, you know so much after 3 decades of being involved with Mexican cuisine and culture that I don't know where to start. This is a marvel of a book called La Cocina Mexicana. Tell us a little bit, how did you first get involved with studying Mexican culture and cuisine, doing tours of Mexico for all these years?
Well, it's rather a two-part story. The first part comes from my father, who was in produce, and we were at the time traveling in all over Idaho, Colorado, Texas, California, you know, wherever the crops were, and I got quite involved with I worked in the fields with the Mexican migrant workers at that time.
Wow.
Definitely migrant workers. And so that's where I first became familiar with the Mexican food. And then, of course, I went on to raise my own family, and my life changed. But then when I remarried my husband, Frederick Townsend, who is a trial lawyer, and he was doing a case in the state of Michoacan.
Oh, wow.
And so he was took me back down to see some of the people he had met there. He was, strangely enough, representing the state of Michoacan against the University of Washington. Anyway,
oh my.
But that was, and one time when we were going there, we got lost on the way to Morelia, where we were going to spend Christmas, and we ended up at the home of Diana Kennedy's, because we ended up in a little town called Zitácuaro. And if you knew my husband, you would know he would just call and ask Diana. But if you knew Diana, she would say, you know, you don't do that. Diana just doesn't like people to drop in on her. But she was very nice to us, and finally she found out that I had some work for the then governor of Michoacan, who was up in the state of Washington where we live, and so I knew he'd given her a cow. And the next thing we knew, we became friends. Well, we spent the day with her then, and we came back many times, and finally she asked me if I would be interested in doing culinary trip throughout Mexico with her, and we started. That was the way it all started.
Oh, wow. And that was what year?
That was, I think, in my first trips were 89, but I think I started that would have been about 87.
I see. Now,
I can't keep track of years anymore.
I know. Well, we all face that. Now, explain the subtitle of this book, because I looked at it over and over again. Many Cultures, One Cuisine.
Well, originally I was going to have it 3 cultures, one cuisine. Because what I did was, when I started this book, I knew there was the whole indigenous, I spent a lot of time with the indigenous people throughout Mexico, and I knew that's where all the food started, but then there was the strong European, particularly the Spanish influence. But then I soon became aware of the African influence that most people don't even, in Mexico, don't even realize.
Yeah, that was amazing when you pointed that out in your book.
Yeah, there were thousands and thousands of slaves that were brought over. Particularly to Veracruz is where they first came in. And so that's why I started saying it was 3 cuisines. But then I realized within the 3, there were many, many, many different. They came from different parts of Africa. The indigenous people are entirely different depending on where they're from. And the Europeans were either, you know, Spanish, French, Italian. So that's where we came up with the word many. Unfortunately, I couldn't bring in all of the other influences that are there because it is become a melting pot with Chinese and others. But those 3 are the first ones, and those are the ones that had the most significant, you know, input.
But why one cuisine? Because I think there are many cuisines. Traveling through Mexico, I found the flavors of each town so different.
In what part now?
And throughout Mexico, the different regions were so different.
Oh, you can go from one valley to the next.
Yes.
And it'll be entirely different. Part of it is, if you're in the indigenous areas, they will cook the much more basic foods, but it's the foods they can grow in their area. If they're in a valley, it's one thing. If it's high up in the mountains, it's a different. And then, of course, certain places, because like in Yucatan, most people don't even recognize it as Mexican food because it's entirely different.
Yes.
It's who has settled there and what their main influences are.
Now, how were you able to get all this information? I mean, it's just an absolute...
I like to ask questions.
Okay. I guess people must have liked to answer your questions.
No, I just have always been curious. That's why I have 2 things that I pride myself on. Is one is my curiosity. Well, that's part of me. And the other is that I'm a connector. And I like to connect one person with another person. And that's just, I found that very easy. I would meet a Mexican-American family. They'd tell me about their family that happened to live in Zacatecas. so I would go there. I connected all over. I don't speak Spanish very well, but I could work in a kitchen, and we get along beautifully.
Oh, see, I was going to ask you, you must be fluent in Spanish, but you're
no,
not.
No, I'm totally tone deaf. I can't sing. I can't. It took me years to even be able to tell the difference between vente and trente. I just don't hear the difference. I have to look at their mouth, but boy, I can work in a kitchen. So I can go into a village kitchen and, you know, I'm accepted once I can do that.
So you show up and ask for an apron and go to work.
Now, how is the reader to approach this book? Because it's so varied. You cover so much information. How do you think people will use this book?
Well, I was asking some people yesterday. We had a book signing yesterday, and they asked me the same question. And I say, start with those things that are the most familiar with you, and then you can sort of move out. Like, if you do something with, say, chilaquiles, those are very simple to make, and you can do that without much problem. But I think it's just start with things that you're familiar with and read about the history about them. Not going to appeal to everyone.
Yeah, I've never heard of pineapple vinegar.
Oh, really?
So I guess it's pretty basic.
Yeah, what ruck have you been hiding under?
So it's pineapple vinegar you can find. It's easy to make, and you find it sold all over in the markets in Mexico. First time I remember in Diana Kennedy's house, she always has this big jug where she has sitting there with all the white scum on the top, the mother on top, they
right.
call it. And it's just, you know, that started me. So I often have mine here making it, too. You can use almost any fruit, but pineapple is the main one. It's very mild.
Apparently vinegars all around are really important to Mexican cuisines.
Oh, yeah.
And why is that?
I think they like that, the contrast with that. It sort of modifies any sweetness they may have put in, but also the chilies, and also it pickles things.
Right.
And there's a lot of things that they use that are pickled.
Yeah, like the escabeche.
Well, an escabeche, yes.
I'm enamored of prickly pears. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I always think this is symbolic of Mexican cuisine from this one plant. Look at everything they get.
Oh, God, yes.
Tell us about it.
I mean, there's not any part of it hardly that's not used. They don't really use the root particularly, but they use almost anything else.
There's such a difference in quality of the pear cactus, the cactus pears. I mean, it's hard getting them. I mean, they grow everywhere, but...
Well, and there's so many different kinds because the choconosli, I love that word, choconosli, starting with an X.
Oh, that's beautiful, yes.
Yeah, I love it. I just love it. But then the other is the very common called tuna. And people say, when we go to the markets, I'll ask the people to go get some tuna. You can imagine what they are, apt to come back with.
Yes, I was researching prickly pear or cactus pears for an article, which I never did complete because I always got it out of season. But I couldn't understand why they were called tuna.
I really don't know.
That's funny. The one thing I learned is you don't ever pick them with your bare hands.
No, you don't.
Which
if you notice the photograph in our book,
yes, the guy
he has heavy rubber gloves on.
Right. The Dorigo family, that they produce the cactus pears, their pickers wear leather. I mean, aprons, gloves, the whole thing. Now, if you crave one particular regional cuisine, what would it be?
Probably Veracruz. It's hard to say because I love them all, but Veracruz and then maybe Oaxaca.
Yeah, I was going to say mine would be Oaxaca. But you would have more it would be more varied in Veracruz.
Yes, very much so. It's a different type of state. Whether you're up in the mountains, you have one kind of thing, and then you have more seafood down on the coast. And to the north, the Huasteca area, you have entirely different kind of foods, and to the south. And I just like that change over, whereas you do have the same thing in Oaxaca. It's a big state also, but there are a lot more similar foods. The only thing I really miss, though, in Veracruz is the fact that you don't have, there's only one or two kinds of moles or some mole de Jico. By the way, my license plate card is Jico. That's probably my favorite place.
That's great.
Another use of the word, like choconosli, it's an X.
You said you just had your 80th birthday, which you celebrated with the Baylesses, and you went to Mexico. Do you still do tours, Marilyn?
Yes, I do tours. I do at least two every single year, and sometimes three. There's, I do some special tours for different groups, like the one I did for the women's chefs.
Right.
And groups like that. But I do one for professionals, particularly chefs, every year, and then I do one for aficionados. And I started with those, but I'm finding one of the things when I set out doing this, I really wanted to do two missions. One was to have the public know more about how varied and wonderful the Mexican foods were, and also about the, you know, the history of it. But just as important were to have chefs that knew how to cook the various kinds of foods across Mexico. And there are all these stores or restaurants that have the sign authentic Mexican food. You know, it may be authentic to what their grandmother cooked in their town or their village, but they don't know other foods. So we started doing those, and they're extremely well attended. I get people signed up almost a year in advance for those. You know, I feel I've done some good in my life because of that.
Do people sign up on your website?
Yes, you can sign up for my trip. It would be www.culinaryadventuresinc.com.
Okay.
And we also have a blog there, too.
Oh, that's good. And how many on a tour?
Anytime between 12 and 20.
Okay.
And I like to keep it smaller, but we have so many people, and I try to have some new people and some, you know, some returnees. Uh-huh. But it's hard because some people that have been on it before keep wanting to sign up a year in advance. But I always try and keep some spots for new people.
Well, I really wish that we were available to go on one of these tours.
Well,
I may surprise you.
I can always find a spot, I think, for you, Ann.
Oh, you're wonderful. Marilyn, thank you. Thank you very much. And happy birthday, since I missed the actual
date.
Well,
thank you. And I hope you enjoy the book.
Oh, I do. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, next up, we have a triumvirate of wonderful cooks, and they've written a book called Muy Bueno, Three Generations of Authentic Mexican Flavor, with recipes and stories. Now, I'm going to identify you. It's a mother and two daughters, and you need to tell us the story of your grandmother as well, because she's there on every page. It is wonderful. We have Yvette Marquez Sharpnack, Veronica Gonzalez Smith. That's a winner, Veronica. and Evangelina, who we're calling Vangie Sosa. Anyhow, here we are. Tell us what this book is about. First of all, tell us about the title. Why is it called Muy Bueno?
Well, this is Yvette, and the reason we named it Muy Bueno, basically that translates to very good in Spanish. Our grandmother, she only spoke Spanish. She's from Chihuahua, Mexico, and came to the United States when she was 10 years old, so only spoke Spanish. And anytime anybody would come into her house, she was always in the kitchen cooking. And so she would always invite somebody, anybody who came over to eat, and she would always say, siéntate a comer, está muy bueno, which means come and sit down and eat, it's very good. And so when we were trying to think of the name for the cookbook, we were all thinking about it and said, we got to think of something Grandma always said. And at the same time, we thought of Muy Bueno, so it was a great fit.
Now, you started this as a blog, right?
We did. In 2010, 2 years ago, we were just going to self-publish a cookbook. And so it was a friend of mine who's the photographer of our cookbook, Janine, who said, I need to be your photographer, and we need to do really nice books.
Oh, the photographs are fabulous. Fabulous photographs.
Thank you. And so we started just initially posting photos on Facebook, and a lot of our friends were saying, well, where's the recipe? And so Janine is actually the one who said, you need to start a food blog. And I did not know what a blog was. So I just finally researched it and looked into it and just started it and figured, okay, well, we'll start giving our friends and family recipes rather than emailing them to each one who wanted the recipes. And we all of a sudden got followers and people who liked what we did. And we found this publisher, and they saw the type of photos that we had in our story, and that's how it all worked out.
Now, are you actually chefs?
No.
We are not. Yeah, no, we're not trained chefs. We're
okay.
Home-cooked. Yeah, homegrown, home-style recipes. Just from Grandma and Mom, so very simple, easy recipes that are not intimidating.
Well, now, each of you adds something to it. These aren't all Grandma's recipes. Sort of modernize some of those. You add some new ones, and actually, you also introduce some fusion, Latin fusion. Is that correct?
Yes, this is Veronica. Yeah, the book is three generations. And so the first generation is our grandmother's recipe that she grew up with and she introduced to Mom, to Vangie, who also taught us how to make those. And then the second generation is Mom's recipes, a little bit of Mexican, a little bit of El Paso. And those are the recipes that Mom has in her book. So that would be our second generation of favorite family recipes that Mom taught us. And then Yvette and I bring to the table the what we refer to as the Latin fusion, all the Mexican ingredients, more modernized and more of a healthy twist to it in terms of eating more fresh, a little bit closer to raw, and just using the same flavors but giving it our little version of cooking because of what we've learned from Grandma and Mom. And, of course, a lot of really fun drinks that we brought to the table, which were
fun
to put together.
You have a great drink section, yeah. How is this cookbook organized? I know you have those little silhouettes saying whose recipe it is. Is the book physically divided into these three different sections?
No, basically it's divided into salsas, our favorite drinks, appetizers, sides, entrees. Then we have a whole section on aguas and paletas, which are juices made from fresh ingredients, and popsicles, iced popsicles, and then desserts. But the little silhouette that is on each recipe is basically just the person who wrote the little story behind the recipe, because we all have memories about all these different recipes. So whoever was either compelled to write the story or actually came up with the drink or the recipe or has the stronger memory is the person whose little silhouette is on each one of the recipes.
Some of these are very surprising to encounter, such as your La Llorona.
Yeah, that seems to be a very popular one that comes up that people always are intrigued by because it's so whimsical and fun because of the dry ice that is inside that drink. And a lot of the recipes, or mainly the drink, we just play with seasonal fruit and favorite alcohol or liqueur that was in season, and so we just kind of came up with some of these drinks by mistake, which turned out to be really cool ideas for the book.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, you sound as though you had just a fabulous childhood and family life. Your grandmother lived to be 98.
Yes, she did. Mom.
I just can't believe that she did all of this by hand without blenders, without any equipment except for those two rolling pins.
Yes, this is Angie. And yes, my mother used a lot of the fresh vegetables all the time. And she used to make the salsa with her hands instead of using I don't think in those days they had a blender.
No.
I think she never did have a blender until later in life.
Well, she had she had a blender, it just wasn't a machine.
And even the red chili for the enchilada, she used to make everything, squeeze the chili with her hands, and then
I can't believe that. That's amazing. You also have a glossary of chilies. But the thing that's probably the most interesting of all of this, I mean, I don't think I'm going to make corn tortillas from scratch, you know. But the stories that go along with all these recipes are fabulous. What are some of your favorite stories? You had people in and out of the house all the time, right?
Okay. Yes. Well, since I was very young, my dad died when I was 10 years old. So I'm the youngest in the family, so I was with her in the kitchen a lot of the times. And I used to be making the flour tortillas. The corn tortillas, that was her specialty. She did them with just hands, and that takes a lot of, it's a gift, I think. I think to me, the older generations are the ones that can make those tortillas by hand, because now you have tortilla pressers.
Yes. And she used to just shape them perfectly with her hand. You have wonderful salsas in here, all different varieties of salsas. And I may try those. But one thing I'm really dying to taste is menudo.
Oh, my goodness. You've never tasted it? You've never had it?
Hominy and tripe soup? No. Especially for breakfast.
Well, that would be our breakfast. Well, New Year's Day or Christmas Day. And in our Latin background, we use this a lot, and we call it the breakfast of champions.
Yes. What's hair on your chest, I'm sure.
Yes, it does. And usually we have more of the menudo in winter.
Now, yes. here's a beautiful photo as well as a beautiful recipe for bruschetta topped apricot melted brie and pomegranate seeds. Now, mm-hmm. that's a modern. That's a, one of your fusions, right?
Yes, this is Veronica. Yeah, that's one of the introductions we've brought into Yvette and I, because we love bries and cheeses, and we've been introduced to bruschettas and other dishes from other cuisines, so we've just borrowed from other things that we like to eat and have brought ingredients from our Latin kitchen and created a whole new twist on appetizers. So that's kind of what we bring to the table, a little bit of a fusion of sort of different cuisines using some very tasty and favorite Mexican ingredients that we like.
This is Yvette. And the pomegranates, I just knew that we had to, you know, publish something with pomegranates, because pomegranates have a special memory for us with Grandma having pomegranate trees in the backyard. Oh, and so, you know, anything with pomegranates, we just all think of Grandma. And it's a beautiful fruit.
Now, each of you claimed, of the daughters, claimed one of the rolling pins that your grandma used. Are you mm-hmm. using them?
Oh, yes. We use them all the time. We use them to make, I use mine the most to make empanadas, especially in the fall and in the winter, you roll out the dough. It's just the perfect little size rolling pin, and what's funny is you really don't even see rolling pins that size anymore. They're just usually a big rolling pin, so I think that's what makes it special for us. You still remember Grandma rolling tortillas every day with those rolling pins or making empanadas, and so those were just some of the best memories that we had growing up watching her in the kitchen.
Well, it's a good women of that generation like to cook, because that was a lot of work.
Yes, this is Veronica. It was a lot of work, but that's what we grew up with. We didn't know. We hardly went out to eat. We did was every once in a blue moon, and Mom was a single mom, so she watched all her pennies. It was just less expensive for us to just eat at home all the time. And as moms ourselves now, each with two of our own kids at home, Yvette and I, we enjoy that. We enjoy cooking for our kids, and your food goes a longer way. You'll cook brisket one day in the crock pot, which is also in the cookbook, and then the next day there's leftovers. We'll use it to make flautas, and then if there's any more left, we chop it up and make taquitos. We'll just make different things with them, just trying to make all our food go further, and that comes from growing up with a grandmother and mother who did the same thing. But I'd like to go back to the rolling pin. That was funny that you bring that up, because when Grandma passed away, Mom did say, is there anything that Grandma left behind that you all want? And Yvette and I, unbeknownst to the other one, asked for Grandma's rolling pin. So when Yvette got one, she goes, I got Grandma's rolling pin. I said, no, I got Grandma's rolling pin. Well, I got her favorite one. No, I did. So we didn't know she had two. So we just love how all this over time has unfolded, and we found out all these things we didn't know before, not knowing she actually had two different rolling pins that are just beautifully weathered, so you can tell how often she used them, but they're both distinctively different, but we both remember the one we got, and so those are the ones that are in our kitchens, and we both still use them.
It's very good to know that the world is a safe place. There's a recipe in here for beef tongue.
That's one of Peter's favorite things.
And I love beef tongue. I just wish we could get it more often. But I leafed a few more pages along, and there's also a recipe for macaroni and cheese. So the world is safe. I know how to make two of my favorite foods the muy bueno way.
There's one big mystery that has remained unsolved for me, and that is I used to have an addiction to what I thought was called Mexican wedding cookies that we got at a bakery in Los Angeles. And for a while I had friends who lived there air freighting them to me, so I always had them. But we called them alligator cookies because they were shaped like little alligators.
Yeah, they were shaped like alligators. Yeah, they came from a bakery in, I think it's Echo Park in Los Angeles.
But the ones you have in here are not shaped like that. They're triangles. And I know that there was cinnamon in the cookies that I had, but I don't know that they had all the other ingredients. Are there varieties, regional varieties of wedding cookies?
This is Angie. Yes, there's also a white powdered cookie that they also call them bizcochos, but they're made with pecans and a lot of butter. And those are covered with confectioner's sugar on the outside.
Yeah, no, these didn't have confectioner's. I used to eat them. I'm so crazy about them. I used to eat them out of the freezer. Mm-hmm. Out of the freezer, no less. But I remember we were someplace, and I called to find out. I found a Mexican bakery, and I asked for if they had wedding cookies. And they said, yes. How big is your wedding? Yeah. And it was like a whole cookie. I mean, like a whole thing.
It was almost as big as an alligator.
Okay. Oh, well, this is Benji, and yeah, I used to make the bizcochos, the recipe that we have in the book, since I was already making them, I think, since I was 14 years old. My mother would love for me to make them for Christmas, but then we used to make them into little triangles, just cut the dough into triangles with just a knife, and just go down and then across and make the little diamond. But now I make it easier with a cookie shooter, and because I make them for weddings or quinceanera or just baby showers or whatever, so they ask me to make them. And so I really enjoy making these cookies, especially for Christmas, the Mexican tradition, to have bizcochos on hand.
Well, you better get, listeners, you better get this book before Christmas. It might sell out, and that would be a shame.
That's one of the recipes that they asked me if it's in there, that one and the tamales, because I also make tamales. And they asked me for tamales, and I sell tamales also at Christmas.
Well, ladies, it has been a delight to have this opportunity to talk to you way down in West Texas. I think that's where you are.
Yes, in El Paso.
And I'm sure you'll be getting ready to celebrate a very Mexican Thanksgiving and a very Mexican, what do they call it?
Mm-hmm.
Feliz Navidad to you and your host from all us here in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Good luck with your book. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we'll be right back, continuing our theme of Close to the Border right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Our next guest is not Mexican. She doesn't live south of the border, but she has certainly a close relationship to the chile, and she's going to warm up your taste buds with her hellfire pepper jelly. There are so many threads to this story. In fact, there's always a story within a story when you're talking to Hillary Danner about her hellfire pepper jelly, Jenkins jellies, and a book called Sweet Heat. I've already got into four different subjects here, Hillary. Where do we start?
Where do we start?
We start where you moved to California. You're an East Coast person, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And you planted things and then decided that you didn't want to waste them?
Yeah, I had a career as an actress, and then I had my boy, and then I was about to have my second child, and we moved to a house that had just the people before me had planted all these trees, fruit trees, and then I put in the vegetable garden, and I suddenly thought, oh, this is so fantastic, and then all of a sudden they all were ready to be harvested, and I didn't know what to do with all the fruit, so I taught myself how to can and preserve and make jams and jellies and took them to food shows, and people went crazy for all of them, but boy, when that pepper jelly arrived on the scene, people just were crazy for it, so
it's
we just kept going. Thank you.
We had it on pork stew, leftover pork stew, heated up for lunch with the pepper jelly, and it was just fabulous.
Surely you must have planted the peppers. I mean, you didn't inherit peppers from the previous owners of the house.
No, I inherited peppers.
See, that's another story. That's your mother-in-law,
yes.
Right?
Right, exactly. She had said there was a lot of spice. The friends loved the chilies, and they're from Texas. And so I planted all these peppers. I didn't even like spice. I didn't know much about peppers. But they were certainly gorgeous, and we planted a bunch of them, and then my mother-in-law said, you should make pepper jelly. It's all the rage, and you know, it's easy. Put it on cream cheese with crackers, and I said, what? So I did, and then it was tasty, and then it got into the hands of Kate Capshaw, who's friends with my aunt, and then she said, if you make it your own and go crazy with it and unique, and I love it, I'll buy a case and send it to Mario Batali, which I didn't even know if that would happen, but I thought it was a cool challenge. So I went to the garden, and I didn't even know what I was picking, but I picked these seven peppers, and I tell you, I'm now a spice fan, and I thought, well, if I can eat this, so we've just gone from there, and it really is about the encouragement when we go to these food shows or events. And I had a store for a small time, and I would serve it at different art gallery nights, and people just, their reaction is what kept going. People have just,
boy, it's very good. It's
well, really, thank you.
I'd like to taste your next flavors. You have three new flavors, right?
Yes.
passion fire, guava brava, and fiery figs. All of them sound absolutely divine.
They really are tasty. They're all great. I think the fig is probably my second favorite.
Yeah, I was going to say that's probably outstanding. Now, I mean, you really had some good connections to get into this business. What kind of acting did you do?
I was primarily a television out here in California, television and commercials. I had a nice little career there and had a blast. Growing up, my mom and dad are in the theater side of it, in opera. My dad was an opera singer and an actor, and my mother was a Broadway dancer for years and then became an opera director. So I would travel with them when I was little, and they would just throw me up on stage and stuff. So I did a lot of that kind of stuff. And then I moved to, sort of had to make a decision which way I was going to go, and then I moved to L.A. and started working in TV.
And you have a partner in this venture, and you have a somewhat famous friend, both of whom undoubtedly helped in the process.
Yes, my partner Maria, she and I met when I first moved out here, and she was with me when we made the first batch of pepper jelly, and I was coughing like crazy. Those seeds are out of control. And we have the hilarious picture of her with a handkerchief around her mouth, and I was a little baby. I was, you know, with a bottle and this knife and peppers. It was really something else. And then it was actually at that point when we decided, forget that. Let's just keep the seeds in the darn thing. It was much easier to deal with. So, yeah.
So that's why there's that extra kick.
Exactly. Okay. I mean, it's just, yeah. Otherwise, I would get kicked every time in the kitchen. I couldn't do it anymore. So
anyhow, the introduction is by Gwyneth Paltrow, who is a cousin, you say, and you grew up together.
Yep. She's my first cousin, and my father and her mother, Blythe Danner, are a brother and sister. And, yeah, and so they were, that side of the family was in a lot of TV and movies, so they were back on the East Coast, West Coast, back and forth. But we grew up, we shared a lot of holidays together, and then I watched her go, as she got older, we'd go over, and she would make these incredible meals, and so it's very cool to see her branching out into her cookbook. And she actually, when we were still sort of just a little hobby, she got a hold of the jelly and I guess just went crazy for it. And then she wrote about it on her Goop, which is her big, you know, blogger. And so that really put us on the map. That was a couple years ago. And that was so funny. I woke up the next morning and I thought, what is all this junk mail I have in my email? And it was actually orders.
Oh, no.
pepper jelly. And I called Maria, my business partner. Said, we got to get a book in here.
Uh-huh.
So that's when I realized, okay, maybe this is really more than just a little hobby. So it's great that she wrote the foreword. That was really lovely.
Now, yeah. This is still not a real giant business, I guess, because you said today you're down in Newport Beach and you're making jelly.
Yes, we had a little bit of a schedule change and I had to come down today. Well, it's exciting. I mean, I obviously don't do it in the kitchen anymore. You're not allowed to. And I outgrew renting a commercial kitchen, and now I work with a co-packer. But I'm here for every batch. I bring and orchestrate all the ingredients. You know, in fact, there was a little pepper snafu today, and I had to go and pick up my organic peppers. And so I'm here selling it, labeling it. So it's a big production, but certainly not a huge factory thing. And I want to be here. I want to be at every, I want to taste every batch. I want to make sure, because I want to keep it as sort of as close as it started. So
comes, the packaging is so swell. I love the packaging.
Thank you.
And it comes with a little spoon that says stir.
Yes. Well, because we found that the seeds would rot the top, and so when we would do our tastings at our shows, it would be mixed around a lot and people would love it, and then sometimes I'd get emails saying, wow, it's a little bit spicier than I remember, and then I realized, oh, you're getting a new jar and the seeds are at the top. So we thought, well, how can we encourage people to stir it up? And so we got this little spoon. I just love it. People really respond to sort of a ready-made gift, especially on the holidays. Not all the stores carry the spoon, but we'll always for it at and online. Because Dean and DeLuca, the reason why I'm down here in a rush doing this is because Dean and DeLuca put us in there in as one of their corporate gift baskets called The Best of U.S.
Okay.
And so that was really exciting. So they wiped me clean and they've got to make more.
Now, I was puzzled about what I was supposed to do with the piece of string.
Right, well,
do I recycle it or am I allowed to throw it away?
You're allowed to throw it away. It is
biodegradable.
It's made of hemp, made in the USA. You know, we try to keep everything as possible local, recycled paper or you know, whatever we can. The peanuts we use, we package our things. They're more expensive, but they're biodegradable, made out of corn. We really try to do that as well. Yeah.
And we haven't really mentioned much about the recipes. I guess I can actually say they're pretty far-ranging. Everything
yes.
from appetizers to desserts.
Yes.
And, you know, and with a lot in between. I mean, here's tilapia with panko crust and spirited saffron sauce, including
yes.
your peppers, your pepper sauce.
Yes.
Cured gravlax. You have gravlax here.
I was just thinking you might have found a recipe for making tilapia acceptable to eat.
I'm telling you, I know.
It's pretty dull stuff.
It's really good though in this recipe, and I wanted to. You know, I'm not a chef.
My next question was under some of these titles, you have chefs' names or people's
yes.
names. So people
yes.
submitted recipes to you?
Exactly. So when I was presented with this idea of doing a cookbook, which was terribly exciting, I thought, oh my goodness. And he said, you're going to have to do 50 recipes. And I thought, wow, okay. So, but people, again, this jelly is what people's reactions, what spurred it on. And since the beginning, people have written me, emailed me, or friends of the family, or whoever, and said, oh, I tried it on this, or I made it with this. And I do have chefs. Friends, and they're included in the book. And then some people who've loved it have passed it on to other people who have restaurants or chefs, and they get excited. And so I thought it was a really great opportunity to highlight other people as well, because it's all based on the people should be genuinely excited to use it. And so worked with them, they submitted it, and then I took most of the pictures, would then test them in the kitchen and then take the pictures. I did have a photographer.
Oh, yeah, that's
so
good,
cut.
Yeah.
Yeah, the cover picture is a lovely photographer, but I realized in the end, this was really something the deadline was beating down the door and I had to get it done. And I was like, well, okay, that's what we're doing today.
I've been there for articles and things. We're recommending this as two ways. One, as a gift, which I think a combination of the book and a jar of the jelly with his little spoon would be a perfect gift for just anything, hostess gifts over the holidays or whatever. But absolutely also get one for yourself because it's delicious. Now, how does one go about getting these besides the Dean and DeLuca catalog?
On our website, we have different retail spots around the country that we are in. I mean, it's not a huge list yet, but we're growing. And then, of course, I have it all online, and I actually just put up our gift basket that's called Happy Hellfire, and it is signed book. Because if it's coming from me, obviously we'll sit with a jar of jelly and a spoon in a pretty little metal basket with a handle. And so it's a very nice present. Ship anywhere in the country, Canada, you know, we ship all over.
Okay.
And so you
address.
Can go on our website.
Your website.
The website is www.jenkinsjellies.com, and that's JenkinsJellies.com.
Of course, that's another story, but we don't have time for that one right now. About why it's called.
Tons of stories.
Get the book, and you can find out why it's called Jenkins
exactly.
Jellies. So,
exactly.
Hillary, a delight talking to you. Your product is delightful also. And
thank you.
Continued success.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And we'll be right back close to the border after our final break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station. www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Next up is a wondrous and wondrously diverse world. Listen to Scott Roberts talk about Salt Lick and their new cookbook.
Which is in Texas, by the way, just in case you're wondering about the Mexico connection.
Scott Roberts, I think you should get ready for that call immediately.
Okay.
to make a movie out of this. You call it a cookbook, Salt Lick Cookbook. But what I saw in it was a major dramatic piece, including history, folklore, personal family matters, tips on agriculture, and the whole story is supposed to be barbecue. Does it encompass all of that?
Yes, it did. You know, I was telling people it ought to be called a family's culinary journey through space and time. But They taught me to just call it a cookbook and then put in the descriptive stuff at the end about a story of family and land and et cetera. But it really is a story of a family and how food related to everything that they did.
The photographs are stunning, absolutely stunning. Does the land
look
that
good? Kenny Braun, the photographer, worked very hard, spent almost a year coming out here at different times of the day. I think he gained a couple pounds, too, he told me. There was a lot of work went into the photographs. Good subject matter out here. It's a very pretty area of Texas.
I was going to say, does it look that good, huh? It takes a lot to get me yearning to go to Texas, to tell you the truth.
Hill Country is different than everybody's conception. And, hopefully we'll be out of a drought.
Yeah, I only know Dallas, and I can't stand Dallas.
Well, Dallas is the prairie, and Austin is completely different than that. We are more equivalent to Paso Robles, California.
Except
they have more dramatic valleys than we do. But otherwise, it looks a tremendous amount like Paso Robles. And another reason why the pictures look so good is because driftwood there's really no town of Driftwood. Driftwood is an area on Onion Creek where there's a lot of switchbacks and doesn't occur anywhere else on Onion Creek. And what would happen is the floods hit this area, the driftwood would settle out, and people came and got their firewood. And the other thing that it was doing in this little valley, it was depositing topsoil. Most Hill Country ranches have about 2 inches of topsoil. We have, underneath some of our vineyards, 18 feet of topsoil. An average about 6 feet over our 600 acres. So that's another reason why the trees look so big and why it's just such a pretty little area.
Now, just to help people along just a little bit and get them interested, essentially your ancestors go back to the days of the Republic of Texas and the Alamo and the whole development of Lone Star State, don't they?
Well, they go back a long ways. They don't quite go back as far as the Alamo and the development. I believe one of the Robertses got here in the 1840s or 50s, but most the Howards that he wrote about most in the book there got here in the 1870s and 1880s. They got here with the large migration from the southeast to the new frontier, which was Texas, that took place from about 1867 to about 1880. Supposedly half the population of the southeastern United States left and came to Texas.
Really? Is that true?
I believe so.
Now half the population of Texas is coming from the opposite direction.
Yeah.
Now, just to bring people up to speed here, you say that the origins of barbecue really took place when your earliest ancestors were migrating to Texas because they were digging pits and cooking as they were migrating. Now,
that's the way barbecue of the style that we do,
which is
and finish up, did. You know, I'm sure some of the origins came from the Spanish of barbacoa. And then I believe some others came from the practice of smoking meats, and it all just came together. But the way that open pit that you see on the cover is a recreation of the way that my ancestors used to cook when they were traveling around Texas in the wagon trains. And then it was handed down from generation to generation. And so that's the way my father was taught to barbecue. So whether if that's the actual origins of Texas barbecue, I'm not sure. But it's the origins of this family, the way we did it, that goes back to the 1800s.
So it was about cooking in the outdoors, because that's
it was about cooking
that
outdoors.
All they had.
What would happen is they would stop and they would build a fire and put rocks down and put grills, and they would season the meat and then sear them and then move them away from the fire. And then if the wind was blowing from a certain direction, they'd put a little earthen berm around that to hold the heat and smoke in. And so that's what you see on our pit. There's the open fire, there's the grill, and then the rock walls are the earthen berms.
And you still cook that way at Salt Lake?
We finish all of our meats that way at the Salt Lake. Everything that does goes across the pits. We do some pre-cooking now in other ways, but the significance of the flavor profiles from back then was really at the end of the cooking, well, during the process. But what happens is that our barbecue sauce has no tomatoes in it. It really started in the southeast, and they brought it over here, and we call it we say it's become Texified, because when it left South Carolina, I'm pretty sure it didn't have cayenne pepper, chili dulce in it. But it has high sugar, high vinegar, and when we put it on the meats over that open fire, it caramelizes on the outside, which is one flavor profile. And then some of the drippings fall and hit the coals and flare back up again with a different smoke, which adds another kind of flavor profile. And then the last profile that we put into it is we take pecan hulls and soak them in water like other people do hickory chips and throw them on the fire.
Yeah,
that gives it a little pecan flavor.
You see, that sounded just wonderful.
Yeah. So that really, that caramelization on the outside of the meats comes from finishing them across those pits.
Now, you have a section to start out with that I found fascinating, just going over all the strong women in your family.
Yeah, about halfway through, well, it was more toward the end. It dawned on me that if you really look at the book, it's about the strong women in my family, my great-grandmother and my grandmother and my mother and my wife. And it just dawned on me that I was really just the messenger. It wasn't my story. I was really just the one that was telling their story. And then I thought, well, I'm sure that it was the same way in all the families of the early settlers in Texas. And so that's why I said I dedicated to them, because without them, there wouldn't be any Texas.
Now, you have a lot of recipes, but you say you hold out on the secret ingredient, and you won't say, what is it?
Oh, no, the secret ingredient, really, is in the book.
Oh.
And our secret ingredient is in the book. If you look at it, it's on two pages, and it's the 250 people in our staff that we took the picture of.
I saw that.
So that's the secret ingredient. The secret ingredient to our dishes and the barbecue stuff is actually you. It's really how much you care about what you're doing. And because if you could start any great recipe, and if you don't pay attention, if you don't look for all the little details and stuff and really work at it, you won't get a great meal or a great dish. And so that's what we say is the secret ingredient. But the only thing that we withheld is we did not put the barbecue sauce recipe in there.
Right. But you do sell your barbecue sauce.
That's probably why.
We do sell the barbecue sauce, but if we put the barbecue sauce recipe in there, we'd have to kill too many people.
Now,
because that's what they say. If you knew what was in my barbecue sauce, I'd have to kill you.
Yes.
But
now you have dry rub and barbecue sauce. Now, can people buy these off your internet website?
Yes, they can buy them off the internet website, but the recipe for the dry rub is in the cookbook.
Okay. And what is your website?
SaltLickBBQ.com.
And you have all these side stories about going hunting with your dad. So you have quail recipes and all the little stories about just the joy of family life in your family, huh?
Yes, it just seems like every story led to a certain dish, or every activity we did either produced a food product that was made into a dish. And there really wasn't much TV.
People lived
very, very, you know, like the closest neighbors that we had when I grew up that were my age were 9 miles away. So food became very exciting.
And I love this photograph of the rusted out Buick.
That was my father's car, and it got torn up and ended up there. And so we decided just to let it fade away.
Now, it was, what year is this, 59?
It's a 1959 Buick Electra 225.
And you know, what did I have, an Oldsmobile? What was the thing?
You called it the Brown Bomber. I don't know.
The Brown Bomber.
It was very similar vehicle to that.
It was even a year earlier. I think it was the Pontiac Bonneville 57. I bought it for four.
It had a million miles on it because my father was building bridges and he used it to travel all over the state of Texas. I mean, at one point in time, he had a bridge job going in Del Rio, one in Marfa, and one in Texarkana. About 900 miles in between Marfa and Texarkana.
And then after he abandoned all that, just opened the restaurant, right?
He just did not like leaving Driftwood on a Sunday evening and not getting back until Friday night late or Saturday morning. So one day he just said, I quit. And called the big company that he subcontracted with and told him he wouldn't do any more jobs. And I could still remember my mother saying, well, what are we going to do? And he said, I don't know. And so they sat down at the kitchen table with a big yellow pad, and they wrote down 54 things they thought up that we could do as a family, and he could stay in Driftwood. And the Salt Lick was the 14th thing on the list.
Oh, really?
And we went through them one by one, and when we actually, and then what happened is that the Salt Lick, when it got started and got going, ate up the other 13 that came before it.
And it's still doing that today. And you feed how many people on any given day?
Oh, well, we'll probably have 700,000 patrons, customers this year.
700,000,
you know,
wow.
A Tuesday is much different than a Saturday. We have maybe 5 to 6 times as many people on a Saturday as we do on a Tuesday.
And when you say five to six times as many, how much does that come to approximately on like a Friday or a Saturday night?
Let's see. On an average Saturday, it's probably 2,800 to 3,000 people.
Oh, my goodness. And do you need a reservation?
We take reservations for parties for 6 or more.
That's it. Otherwise, you just take your chances, huh?
Yeah, we seat almost 800 people when we open everything up. And so normally the waits, even on the Saturdays, don't average much longer than an hour. But we have outdoor live music and you can walk around to entertain you. And then you can also walk around on the area. We have garden, nice trees. And
so it's a destination. Now, are you open for lunch and dinner also?
We open at 11 in the morning and close at 10, and we're open every day of the year except for Thanksgiving Day and Christmas Day.
Now, I was looking to see, since your mother was Japanese, or is Japanese, you said she just turned 99, which is amazing, absolutely amazing, and there doesn't seem to be any Japanese influence on the menu, is there?
Well, every generation tweaks the recipes just a little bit, except for mine. I mean, I'm not going to, because to me, it's not broke, so I'm not going to fix it. But my mother's tweaking was she added popped sesame seeds to the potato salad and the coleslaw.
Okay.
And then she added one thing to the barbecue sauce. She added powdered ginger to the barbecue sauce.
Really? Powdered ginger? That's unusual, huh?
And then my father came up, his tweak was he came up with a process to whereby we chill our meats for 24 hours during the cooking process, because we found our proteins and our beans are more like chili. They taste better the second day. So we actually cook up to a certain stage, then we rapidly cool and let it stay at 38 degrees for a minimum of 24 hours and no longer than 48, and then bring them back up to temp and finish them across the open pit. And it actually, we feel, it enhances the flavor. It kind of makes all of them blend together.
Well, I make my stews and braises. I always make them the day before.
Yes. So that chilling process, we think actually there's something chemical that takes place, but in our case, it enhances the flavor, and so that was his. And like I said, I don't see any reason to change anything.
Now, the bulk of the cookbook, of course, is barbecue. You also do sausages, and you do, as you've mentioned, sides, coleslaw, potato salad, and some of them are sort of unexpected, like smoked curried oyster on sweet potato chip with cucumber sauce.
So making barbecue is really a wonderful experience, but every mind wanders at time, I guess, or something. So my father used to cook. He was perfecting steak. He was going to age sirloins, do certain nights where he'd also grill steaks. And so our deal was just, you know, looking at local products and coming up with different recipes. And so the state of Texas has a wonderful, wonderful resource, and that's the Gulf Coast. And there's wonderful oysters and crab and flounder down there, so that's where we came up with that smoked oyster. We started smoking our own oysters, and that's where we came up with that little recipe. And now then, we're working on barbecued oysters, where we take them, oysters on the half shell, and we put garlic butter and dry rub, Parmesan cheese, and then we grill them over oak coals, and that comes out really good. And now that we're working on a barbecued shrimp that we would serve as kind of like a light menu appetizers over at my daughter's Salt Lake Cellars wine shop.
Yeah, I forgot to mention about the wine.
So this is quite an enterprise. And before we went on the air, I asked you how long does it take to drive there from Austin, and you said about 25 minutes. So listeners, if you're anywhere near the Texas Hill Country, I guess, it's not like you don't need an excuse. You need a reason, but the reason's in this book and the decades and centuries of heritage that come before that. Scott, thank you so much for bringing not an American story, but I guess a Texas story.
Yes.
To On the Menu Radio, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much. It was an honor.
I hope to see you soon, Scott.
Please.
Well, adios, amigos. El mismo. That's about as far as I can go next week.
say goodbye. You all come back now. Do they say that in Texas? Probably. So. So anyway, we hope you all will come back to On the Menu Radio, same time, same place next week, and we'll look forward to talking to you then.
Bye-bye.